I published for you, I printed out for you parts of a long, long essay. I mean, it's probably 100 pages on Torah Shebal Peh, on the Oral Torah. And it's written by Rabbi Berkowitz from Yerushalayim. And he has a very, very fine command of the English language, very unusual for something coming out of Yerushalayim. And I tried to focus on the main points that I thought would re-strengthen what we've said in the past.
What's your choice?
Oh, this is good for me.
Good.
Yeah, thank you so much. So, first of all, in terms of the development of Torah, we spoke about the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, when he authored the Mishnah, he was very concise. We've said that over and over again. And here's the explanation. When it comes to the written Torah, the words are critical. We will dedicate all our time and all our energy to understand the words. The words are written by God Himself, and therefore they have inherent sacredness. However, in the case of Torah Shebal Peh, there's nothing inherently sacred in the word. But rather, Torah Shebal Peh is concepts, abstract ideas. The wording is nothing more than a means to an end, a vehicle to communicate ideas. There's nothing, again, inherent in the words. It's not like Tanakh, where the Navi is inspired by the divine revelation, and therefore the words have significance in and of themselves. So, for example, in the case of Tanakh, if a person would read the words of Tanakh, he doesn't understand the word of what he's reading, he still has some sort of mitzvah. It is still meaningful, even though he doesn't understand them, because in Torah Shebichtav, in the written Torah, it's the word itself that is significant, because it's given directly from God. In the case of the oral Torah, there's nothing significant in and of itself in the word. The word is only meant, as we said, to transmit the message. And therefore, when Rebbe authored the Mishnah, he was getting into kind of a dangerous area, because he was, in effect, reducing the Torah Shebal Peh, which is conceptual, into words. So in order not to limit and confine the experience of transmission of the oral law into the written format, what Rebbe tried to do to preserve the need for a transmission, an oral transmission, a mesorah, he allowed students to appreciate that they would have to go beyond the text, that the text itself would not be sufficient. They would need a transmission, they would need a Rebbe, they would need to learn in an academy, in a yeshiva, and that's how the oral Torah would be preserved in its original form. We've spoken about in the past the fact that there was a point about the year 500 in the Common Era in which the Talmud became a closed book. That's called Chatimat HaTalmud or Chasimus HaTalmud. And once the Chasimus HaTalmud was closed, was clinched by Ravina and Ravashi, after that point, we have the end of the period of what we call the Yud Gimel Midos Shatorah Nidreshes Bahem, the period of Chazal, who are able, with the tools that were given through Torah Shebal Peh, to be mechadish, to come up with new ideas and derive new concepts from the Torah itself. We spoke about the fact that the Talmud and even the Mishnah records machlokes. Machlokes is what? Disagreements, arguments. Correct, excellent. And with regard to the arguments, we study both sides of the argument. The Torah is not limited to one side. There's nobody who's right. And the reason for that is because of the principle of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. And Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim is interpreted by the Ran, a very important Ran in his drashot. This drasha saran, in the seventh drasha, the Ran understands that what this means, Elu ve'elu, is that both sides of the machlokes were given to Hashem, by Hashem, to Moshe at Har Sinai. And this is very significant, because it means that Moshe Rabbeinu was given the roots and the concepts, and the specific interpretations thereof, which lend themselves to various possibilities, those would be developed over the course of time. So therefore, according to the Ran, each side of a machlokes has roots in the Torah that was revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, and therefore Moshe was told that to decide eventually halakha, what we call normative halakha, we need to rely on certain rules. For example, majority rules, we go after the majority. But nevertheless, even though we paskin, we decide in favor of the majority, we tip the scale in favor of the majority, that doesn't mean that the majority is truth and the minority is not truth. Far be it from that. There's a greater truth which may reflect itself in the minority view. There's some sort of a higher truth that would combine both opinions. And the one who develops this the most, you'll see on page 2, is the Yam Shel Shlomo. The Yam Shel Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Luria, in his introduction to Masechta Bava Kamma, he has a new idea, but it's very much similar to what we've seen before. It's a deeper, more esoteric, perhaps even Kabbalistic approach to what we've seen before. How could you have two opinions and they're both truth and they both have to be studied as part of Torah? So he says, based on these esoteric insights, that when we received the Torah at Har Sinai, there was some sort of flow of Torah that came down from the higher worlds through what's called Tzinorim. In other words, it came down through pipelines. So each individual received his particular part or segment of the Torah. That's why we say V'sein Chalkeinu V'sarasech. Everybody has their own part in the Torah. We couldn't, each and every one of us was not capable, we didn't have the capacity to receive the entire spiritual flow of the Torah. It was too overwhelming. So in a sense, the Torah was split into various parts. So what we received is our particular segment. If we can combine all those segments together, if we can have a communal Torah in which everyone contributes his particular perspective, that would give us the overall picture. But yet each segment of the piece, of each piece of the puzzle is also genuine. It's also true within the context of the broader totality. And when you split the Torah into its smaller parts, then what you get is conflicting rulings. You get a machlokes. So two people receive the same spiritual message that would flow from heaven, but it sort of arrived and was received in two different ways. It was split through these channels, these pipelines called Tzinorim. And as a result, they arrive, each one of those recipients arrives at his own unique conclusion. But in truth, the overall message of the Torah is neither like Reuven nor like Shimon. It's nor like A nor like B. It's really like neither of them, because both of them, every one of them has a segment of the truth. But in any event, this Yam Shel Shlomo, it's very important to emphasize, is a continuation, is building on the Ran, because the Ran says that Eilu Veilu Divrei Elokim Chayim means that both opinions, both sides of Machlokes were given at Har Sinai to Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore they're both genuine, they're both true Torah. They're different perspectives of the truth, but they both belong to the truth. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein, you've all heard of Rav Feinstein, and his famous work, The Igros Moshe, he writes in his introduction a different approach. And maybe this is the approach of Rashi and other Rishonim, that there's really only one truth. That Eilu Ve'Eilu doesn't mean that both opinions are true. One of the opinion is not true, made an error. But he consoles us and he says that we shouldn't worry about that, because within the context of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, the Torah does not expect that our mitzvah is limited and conditional on the fact that we come up with the correct truth, as long as we're learning Torah through the method that was transmitted to us, through the forms and the systems that were genuine to that. He writes that even if we choose mistakenly the wrong approach in a specific halakha, we don't have to worry, we won't be held accountable, as if to say that we performed the mitzvah incorrectly, but rather we will receive reward for following our understanding, as long as we arrived at that conclusion based on an honest to goodness dedication and awe. He says, he speaks about Yirat Shamayim, the fear and the awe that we have to have for the significance of Torah study. So these are a few pointers that we've spoken about in different ways in the past, and I just wanted you to hold on to that. And now, without further ado, please pick up your sheet, which is called Shakla Vitaria. Do you remember from last time that we spoke about that phrase, that very important phrase called Shakla Vitaria? Who remembers what Shakla Vitaria means?
Give and take.
Correct. This is what the Talmud is all about. The give and take, the arguments in this direction and in that direction. And surely what we'd like to do, if we could only find a shortcut to understand the structures of these dialectical debates, or back and forth, question, answer, proof, and rejection of proof that appear in the Gemara and make up the entire body of Shas. So what I've chosen for you here tonight, and I hope the experiment will work, it's just an experiment, I hope you don't mind being my guinea pigs, I've chosen 15 mini-sugyas. Meaning, you know, if you walk out of this year, you now can say that you learned 15 different Gemaras. But we're only going to cover a small portion of the Gemara. And our purpose in each case is to focus on a phrase, or two phrases, or sometimes three phrases that really capture the structure of the Gemara. So what I did in each case is I tell you first where to find the Gemara. So you should know it has an address. I didn't invent it. I tell you usually if it's a Mishnah or a Gemara. If it says Torah Rabbanan, it's not a Mishnah nor a Gemara, it's a Braisa. You remember we spoke about the Tanaitic literature that was left out of the Mishnah. That's called Torah Rabbanan, it's a Braisa. And in each case, I underlined what I considered to be the key words. And what I'd like you to do as we go along is, and you may be able even to do this right now without further ado, but write down the translation of at least those words that I underlined. And again, this is a training, this is an exercise that'll sort of pump us up, you know, for starting Masechet Megillah, which Mirtz Hashem will be starting, hopefully, in the very near future. So the first source that I want to look at is the Gemara in Bava Metzia. In fact, it's the first Mishnah in the third parak of Bava Metzia, on Daf Lamed Gimel on the days. Bava Metzia belongs to that section of Shas called Nezikin, which means the laws of monetary interactions, whether it be financial arrangements, whether it be loans, perhaps tort law, which is Nezikin, that's primarily in Bava Kama.
Now that's a term that the lawyers will understand.
Yes, tort law, even I understand that, you know, and I'm not a lawyer. And then you have, of course, the second parak of Bava Metzia, the one before this one, which is traditionally what they begin, you know, children with. I started on that parak. It's called Elu Metziot. How many people like me started off on Elu Metziot? In fourth grade, I remember Elu Metziot. Now I look back at Elu Metziot and I think it's what can I tell you? It's wasted on children. Even today, I don't know if I can figure out what's going on over there and how they teach it to fourth graders, I don't know. So the third parak in Bava Metzia is called Hamafkid. And let's spend a minute giving a little background to what Hamafkid is. In a case where I possess an object, but I'd like you to be in charge of watching it, of guarding it. You become my sort of custodian, so to speak, to watch the object. And the word for that is shomer, and a shomer is someone who takes upon himself responsibility to guard the object. There are also rental arrangements in which you rent something, and included, inherent in your rental agreement is that you'll be careful with the object and make sure to return it to me whole, the way I gave it to you. And the verb for the act, to describe the action of giving something over to a shomer, that's called mafkid. Okay? Now, the Mishnah goes in and gets very, very specific. And it tells you exactly what was given over to this shomer. And in effect, the Mishnah formulates two categories of objects that were given over to the shomer. One is called behema, which means a live animal, and the other one is called kelim, which is called utensils. So if you want to, again, I don't know, you know, how much of this is necessary for you, how much of this is superfluous, that's a very subjective question, but I do recommend that you circle the words behema and kelim, so that you can come back to this and see that the Gemara is going to jump on the Mishnah and try to figure out the relationship and the necessity, in this case, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the Mishnah, to have both Behema and Kalin. And the Gemara says as follows. I'm going to read the whole line, and then we'll get back to the parts that are underlined. Lamali lemisne behema, v'lamali lemisne kalin. Why did the Mishnah find it necessary lemisne to write behema and lamali lemisne kalin? Now, what's the next word after that? Tzrichi. Okay, now tzrichi is what's called, if you make it into a noun, tzrichusa. It's the same word, just so you add a tough aleph. And I point that out to you is because the Shas is full of what's called tzrichusas. A tzrichusa is a word that describes that structure where there's more than one word to describe what seems to be pretty much the same thing. And because of the apparent superfluous nature and the repetitive nature, we need what's called a tzrichusa. And now the Gemara goes on into a long discussion, which is not for us tonight, because as I said, we're only doing mini-sugyas. We're only seeing the part of it. The Gemara goes on to a long-winded discussion why I would think that the halakha might change between live animals and inanimate objects. And therefore the Mishnah felt compelled to write both, Behema and Kalim, live an animated object and an inanimated object. I just want to point out, and we're going to come back to this again and again, that a tzrichusa has to be a two-way street. A tzrichusa, it's like a t'nai kafel, Ralph. Remember we discussed once t'nai kafel. It's got to be in both directions. The tzrichusa has to, in order to suffice, in order to satisfy our needs, it has to tell me the following. Why is kalim a chiddush? Meaning, if I only had behema, an animal, I would not derive kalim. I would think kalim is different. But it's got to go the other way around. If I had kalim, why do I need behema? Why is it necessary for every tzrichusa to go in both directions? Can anybody answer that? This is not a rhetorical question. I mean to really throw this out. You know.
Well, I mean, if he had sort of a kal v'chomer thing, then only one would be necessary.
Which one would be necessary? If using your model of a kal v'chomer,
well, it depends on the argument.
No, I don't think so. I think it's a universal rule. It would either be the cow or the chomer.
If you want to say that something is okay, then you need the chomer, the cow comes along for the ride. If you want to say that it's severe, then you need the cow, the chomer comes along for the ride. So it depends on...
Okay, so I'm not exactly sure what you mean, Lawrence, but just for the sake of time, what I'm going to say is the following. When you have two cases or two variables, one is a more greater chidush, a more greater revolution than the other. Meaning, tell me the more radical case, and then I will, by inference, derive the simpler case. Again, using your model, tell me the chamur, and I know the kal. I don't need you to spell out the kal. So therefore, if let's say I only had behema, I wouldn't know kalim, because kalim is the chomer, that's a more radical case. So tell me kalim, and don't tell me behema. So it's always going to work in both ways, because there's got to be a separate chidush, some new insight in both kalim and a behema. This one has something that this one doesn't have, and vice versa. Alright, let's go on to the Gemara in Brachos. This is a very interesting Mishnah in Brachos. Nashim v'avadim uktanim pturim mikriyachma. So the Mishnah outlines three categories of individuals who are exempt from the mitzvah of kriyachma. And we're going to focus today on the first of those three categories, namely nashim, women. Why are nashim exempt from the mitzvah of kriyachma? The truth of the matter is, if you have any general knowledge whatsoever, you don't need this Mishnah. You know that women are exempt from kriyachma. And what is the general principle that we need to know? Are women obligated in mitzvah, or are they not obligated in mitzvah? If I want to take a test, a litmus test for any particular mitzvah. Excellent. Oh, I see we're all... this is a pleasure. I gave a shiur on Shabbos on a different topic to a different group, but I wasn't getting any responses, so it was really hard for me. Okay, I see tonight we got a lively group, Baruch Hashem. Although a few people are not here tonight, I hope they'll be back on another occasion. So that's what the Gemara right away asks. Take a look, Gemara. And I added the word Gemara here, so you know it's the Gemara. Analyzing, of course, the Mishnah. Kriyat Shema. pshita? You have to tell me that Kriyat Shema, women are exempt? Pshita. Now, how do I know the Gemara is referring to women? Because the next line, mitzvah saseh shazman gromu. This is a time-bound mitzvah. You know, it's the Kriyat Shema in the morning is limited to the morning. The Kriyat Shema at night is limited to the night. V'chol mitzvah saseh shazman gromu. Any mitzvah which is time-bound, shazman gorem, the zman, the time, says a set time, noshim pturos, women are exempt. So first of all, we introduce the word pshita. Now we introduce another couple of words. Because whenever there's a pshita, the pshita should be followed by, you should anticipate this even blind without even looking at the next line, a mao detema. Or sometimes a little different, it's hava amina, but it's the same. Mao detema, I would have thought, I would have said. Meaning if not for this Mishnah, I would think that somehow Kriyat Shema, despite the fact that it's a time-bound mitzvah, nevertheless, it's an exception to the rule. And there's some overriding necessity or pressing reason why women should be included in this mitzvah because of its unique nature, despite the fact that it's time bound. Hoil since, again, I don't expect you to learn all these words overnight, so don't get nervous. It's only the words that I underline that you have to learn. Hoil and since, the isba, it has within it. Ba is Lashon Nekeva because Kriyat Shema is Lashon Nekeva. Kriyah is a feminine word. And we're also talking about females. Maybe that's another point. Malchut Shamayim, the yoke of heaven, the kingship of God. Meaning, what's the essence? What we call in our language, the kiyum. If you want to write that down. Kuf, Yud, Vav, Mem, the kiyum. What's the kiyum? Meaning the kishkis, the purpose, the goal, the essence of Kriyat Shema. What's the kiyum of Kriyat Shema? Anybody? Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim. We got to get the terminology. Again, my whole purpose here is not to give you, you know, the fancy English. Sometimes I'll wax a little fancy if I can to show you that I went to school. But what really is more important to us tonight is the language itself, the Lashon Kodesh. So in Lashon Kodesh we call it Kabbalat Malchut Shemayim, accepting upon oneself Malchut Shemayim. This is the essence of what all the mitzvot are all about. I mean, if you don't accept upon yourself the yoke of mitzvot, then there's no point to go on. I mean, we've lost the ball game before we started. In effect, the purpose of man and the creation of man is for the goal of accepting upon ourselves the yoke of Shemayim. Women, just as much as men, need this. And therefore, we would think that there's an overriding... This is the Mao de Tema. Again, the Mao de Tema, whenever you see it, suggests an exception to the rule. And then the Gemara goes on to say what? Kamashmalon. Again, a classical structure. Kamashmalon means that the Mishnah, therefore, has to tell me that despite that pressing logic, that overwhelming reasoning.
Or what would appear to be.
What would appear to be, nevertheless, women are exempt. Now, here, I have to say a few words about the structure. Whenever you see a Mao de Tema, followed by a Kamashma, you always, must always, you've got to make it second nature. Ask the following question. Does the Kamashma completely reject the Mao de Tema? Or does it basically accept the Mao de Tema, but says nevertheless? Do you follow the difference? You know, it's... Is it an outright rejection, the Kamashmalan? Forget it, you made a big boo-boo, you're absolutely mistaken, or no? Maybe what the Gemara is saying is that the logic and the reasoning, and maybe even some consequences to that reasoning, are correct, but Kamashmalan, in this particular context, this is the, not the rule, but the exception. So you see, the question would be, again, this is way beyond what I want to discuss with you tonight, but the question is, do women have to read Kriyat Shema in a different way than men do? Maybe that it's not time-bound, maybe it's not limited to a certain bunch of paragraphs and so on. Women have to accept Ol Malchut Shemayim. That, the Gemara never rejects that. The Gemara still accepts the fundamental reasoning of the Mao de Tema, even at the end of the discussion, which is called Maskara, but we'll get to that word another time. Even after the Kamashma, women need Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim no less than men do. They have to accept upon themselves the yoke of heaven, but not in this particular form. The way the Mishnah formulates it, that Kriyat Shema has to be read, three paragraphs, at a certain time, within the framework of tefillah and so forth and so on. But again, that's the rule of thumb. You always have to be tricky, you know, it's a little tricky not to take a Kamashma on at face value, always dig a little deeper below the surface. The third Gemara that we're going to cover tonight, and again, I enjoy this because it gives us a little bit of a taste, you know, it's like a bee that goes from flower to flower, is the Mishnah at the beginning of Psachim, which deals with the rabbinic obligation of what's called Bedikas Chametz. We're all familiar with the fact that on the night of the 14th, that's a day, 24 hours before Pesach starts, we have to search for Chametz, Li'or Haner, to the light of a candle. Now, the Mishnah, if you take a look, adds a word over here. And you might not notice the extra superfluous word. The Mishnah wants to tell me which places within my domain need, absolutely require bidika. Like, what happens if you have a storage area where nobody ever goes in there with bread? You know, there's a sign outside, you know, all food off campus, you know, prohibited. So that's called a makom she'ein machnisin bo chametz, a place where you don't bring in chametz. And the Mishnah wants to tell me that you're only obligated to check those places which are machnisin bo chametz. So the Mishnah says the following: kol makom she'ein machnisin bo chametz ein tzarich bedika. Any place that chametz doesn't enter there does not need bedika. It's a double negative, meaning you only need bedika in a place where chametz goes in. But if no chametz goes in, you don't need bedika. But notice one extra word. And this extra word is gonna appear over and over and over again, and it's always gonna generate the same response in the Gemara. And which extra word is that?
Kol.
Exactly. So underline the word kol. I didn't do that for you because I wanted you to find it on your own. Kol makom shein. Whenever you see the word kol, kol is always coming to include something. Because otherwise, drop the word kol. So this is a very important structure that we're going to have that's called the Lasuye Mai structure. Lasuye Mai means that the extra word is obviously coming to include something. Which means it's telling me something extra. And the Gemara uses the following term. Omar Mar. We go... not Omer, my mistake. Kol makom lasuye mai. I underline the words lasuye mai. To include what? What is the extra word kol coming to include? And the Gemara says, lasuye hadisna, the Tanur Rabbanan, something which was left out of the Mishnah. What's Tanur Rabbanan again? I'm going to hit you with this over and over again. What's Tanur Rabbanan? Which rabbis? Where? Again, you have three choices. A Mishnah, a Braisa, or a Gemara? A Braisa. Tanur Rabbanan means a Braisa. That which is written by Tanoim but left out of the Mishnah is called a Braisa. And that's Tanur Rabbanan. What does it say in the Tanur Rabbanan? Chorei bayis ha'elyonim v'hatachtonim. That there are certain little orifices, little places where you store things within the kotel. You know, if you have a wall, you know, in your storage area, there are spaces, small spaces between the boulders, you know, the crevices. Yeah, if you're a dentist, I mean, you have to fill those crevices. But if you're a, I guess if you're a carpenter, then in those days they found it very functional to hide things between the thing. So the question is, would I need bedika in those cracks and crevices? So he says, kol makom, even a place which you usually would hide something. You know, let's say you had some sharp, let's say a knife or a you know, a nail clipper, I don't know what, something small that you wanted to hide and protect it, you would put it in there, but we don't assume that there's any chametz. And for that, the Mishnah had to hint at the word kol. Now notice, this is exactly what we've been talking about for three lectures now. That Rav Yehuda Anasi deliberately was very abridged. He didn't tell us anything about chorei bayis elyonim v'tachtonim. All he did was add the word kol. Do you follow me? And that forces us to jump into this dialectic and this whole transmission, the oral transmission of Torah Sheba'al Peh. We move on to number four. Okay, now number four, I was vacillating back and forth about whether I should include this here because it's very complicated. But again, my goal here is not that you learn Masechet Shabbos. We're not going to stand here on one foot and learn Masechet Shabbos, which is one of the most, if not the most complex tractates in the Talmud, but
we've been doing it for close to 3 years in the mornings.
Okay, if you'd been doing it for 3 years, I probably wouldn't have even gotten by this sugya and avav in 3 years. It's so complicated. This is called Arba Rishuyos L'Shabbos. There are four different domains in Shabbos. This represents 1/39th of the negative commandments of Shabbos. There are a whole bunch of positive commandments. And even within that 1/39th, which is called Melechus Hotso, which means carrying, where you're not allowed to carry something from one domain to the other, even here we're only touching on one dimension of that particular Melechah. I mean, Hotso goes on and on with Zrika and Moshit and Erevin and so forth and so on. But there are four Rishuyos, the most famous of which we all know, and I'm sure you're all familiar with these terms, are a Rishus HaYochid and a Rishus HaRabin. Okay, there are other areas that are much more complicated. For example, this shtender, it would be what? Anybody know what that would be called? Well, maybe it's a little bit too large, but this would be called a makom p'tur. Anything like, I don't know if you use the same term in Canada. In America, we call it a fire hydrant. Use the same term. So a fire hydrant would be a makom p'tur. Anything that has a very limited space on top, that would be called a makom p'tur. Okay. In any event, it says in the Braisa, which is number Dalit on your page, let me just give this to you. Okay. One for the little guy?
Not so little anymore. Boy, he's getting big.
Okay. So what does it say in the Braisa? This is number Dalit. Arba Rishuyos L'Shabbos. There are four different domains that are relevant to Shabbos. And we're talking now about Rishus HaYochid, Rishus HaRabim, Carmelis, and Makom P'tur. Now, the four Rishuyos are not relevant to me tonight, as I told you before, but take a look at the Braisa in the next line. The Ezohi Rishus HaYochid. Let's get that language. The Ezohi Rishus HaYochid. That makes sense. You know, you've mentioned that there are four. Now define them for me. So which one is the first one? Tell me what it is. The first one's called Rishus HaYochid. But after the Braisa answers that question and defines Rishus HaYochid, there's a bookend that closes the discussion. And it says again, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. Now, if you were writing a treatise in which you were presenting the four different domains of Shabbos, which words would be totally superfluous? Could be completely erased, omitted from the text. Anybody? I didn't underline it because I wanted to see if you'd come up with it on your own. Yeah, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. I mean, you just told me.
What immediately follows that?
Oh, then it goes on and says V'ezi Rishus HaRabim. But
okay, so
my point only is you've got a sandwich here. You started by saying Ezi Rishus HaYochid, and you have this whole line over here. Gader, Gavoa, Sara, Rachav Arba, Charitz, which is a tail, is a bar, that's Amok Asara, Rachav Arba, and so forth and so on. And then Nachamol, again, he goes over it, he says, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. Why is that necessary?
The phrase that immediately follows would suggest that it is now going to discuss a different one, and therefore we finish talking about the first one, which means you don't have to say we're now thinking.
Exactly, 100%. That's exactly the problem the Gemara is going to face here. Omar Mar, you, Mar, in the Braisa said at the closing end, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. You know, it's almost as if you said, you know, Rishus HaYochid is A, B, and somebody was about to say C, and then we said, no, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. Ad Kan, this is the end. In other words, the bookend here is sort of like a counterforce that's saying, don't go beyond this line. You know, this is the red line. You know what I'm talking about? You know, like if you, I don't know if you've been a little out west here, they got the glaciers, you know, so they tell you how close you can come. You know, don't go beyond this line. They keep moving the line back, by the way, every year. Anyway, so this is Zuhi Rishus HaYochid. Don't even step beyond this. That's going to lead the Gemara to raise the fine question. Lim'ute mai means you're pushing me back because otherwise, logically, I would have gone one step further. And in fact, Rabbi Yehuda did go one step further. And he has a case called Shnei Batim B'Shnei Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. And he defines that as a Rishus HaYochid, even though it's open on two sides. So since Rabbi Yehuda added a third category, and the Tanakhama, meaning the first Tana here, rejected Rabbi Yehuda, and he wanted to point out that there are two categories and only two categories. Therefore, he added the bookend, Zuhi Rishus HaYochid, almost as a pointer to indicate, Teidalecha, you should know that there's something more that logically we could have extended and we want to tell you not to. That's called Lim'utei Mai. Once again, on the side, whenever you see Lim'utei Mai, what you want to do at that point is you want to create conceptual categories. What I mean is to say, if you have a concept and the Braisa, it could be a Mishnah, it could be Gemara, but the Braisa goes ahead and says, what's included in that concept? And it's got A, B, C, and D, but it doesn't have Z, Y, you know, X, Y, and Z. So whenever you see that, you create categories. You assume that the cases that are explicitly mentioned somehow blend and have a common denominator that form one category, and the case that was excluded introduces a new category. In this case, Rabbi Yehuda had a new definition of Rishus HaYochid, which is radically different than the first definition of Rishus HaYochid. Okay. Number Hey comes a little bit closer to home because we're learning Masechta Kiddushin here. The Mishnah says, Ha'isha niknes b'shalosh drachim. A woman is married in three ways, three methods. V'kones atzma, but she goes back into her own domain in two ways. What's a little bit superfluous about this Mishnah? Well, you have to know a little bit more of the Mishnah. The Mishnah goes on to delineate what are the three methods of Kiddusha. Now again, I'll ask my question. What is superfluous in the Mishnah? I'll read it again. I was hoping for a better response. Ha'isha niknes b'sholos drachim. A woman can be married off in three ways. The konas asks if she undoes the marriage relationship in two ways. What's superfluous here? Because the Mishnah is now going to delineate one, two, and three. So what's absolutely unnecessary?
Numerical.
Correct. Why do you say the number? As I always say, it's a little bit facetious, but I mean it to dramatize. I can count to three. You know, I don't know about four, but I can count to three. So you didn't have to tell me that there are three ways. You went ahead and you told me Kesef, Shtar, and B. You gave me the three ways. I can count them up.
But you might think that's one way that requires all three to occur. And
okay.
And any one of them, it's failed.
Okay, maybe you might think that you need all three or so, but the Gemara, we're not interested really in the answer of the Gemara, I'm interested more in the...
No, but if it didn't say three ways, you might think
that
this package of three is a package and has to be complete.
Right, Lawrence, you're 100% correct, but all I'm pointing out is that whenever you see a number in a Mishnah, this is what you can expect. Minyana limute mai. What's the purpose of counting up the number? Now, the Gemara asks this question twice. And this is also important for me that you know. Minyana de resha limute mai. Minyana de seifa limute mai. Who remembers the difference between the resha and the seifa we discussed the last time? Don't all answer once. Who remembers the ratio of the safe? You have last week's notes. If you don't know.
Ratio is the first part.
Yeah, ratio is the first part and safe is the last part. So in the ratio it says, Aisha nicknames Bishal Shrachim. So it numbers the number of methods of a marriage. Konis Atzma Bishal Shrachim. And she gets out of the marriage in two ways. So we have a double question over here. Number one, Minyana de Ratio. Limute mai means what are you coming to exclude? Three and not four. Minyana de Seifa, Limute Mai, two and not three. Now we go on to a Mishnah Megillah, because this is the Mishnah we're going to be studying in Mirtz Hashem. The Mishnah says, Megillah Nikres Ba'Chadasar. That's the earliest date in Adar for the reading of the Megillah is the 11th of Adar. So this is a classic. The Gemara says, Minolan. From whence do we know that? How did the Mishnah know such a thing that the Megillah is read on the 11th of Adar? Well, what do you think is implicit, not spelled out here, in the Gemara's wonderment here about Minoan? No, but why is the Gemara saying, how do you know? I mean, what's bothering the Gemara? Why is the Gemara really... What?
What's the source?
No, but I'm saying in this particular case, there's a very dramatic reason why the Gemara is searching high and low for the source.
Well, the holiday is on the 14th, so
we're talking
about...
Right, and where, Lawrence, if... Let's say I would get up here just for the fun of it and say, no, the holiday starts on the 11th. Why would you laugh me out of here? Because there's a calendar here for Shari Shamayim? Why would you laugh me out?
How can you back that?
No. I'm saying
it's on the 14th.
No, I'm saying
you know it's on the 14th. No, I say it's on the 11th. Do me something. Throw me out. But no, seriously, I'm not joking now. What?
Is it show me?
No. But I'm asking. Maybe my question is so simple that's why you're not asking. You know, I'm talking like to a first grader here. I'm saying, what? You Minoan. How do you know such a thing? It can't be on the 11th. Why not? Maybe it is on the 11th. Why can't it be on the 11th?
Well, it is logically on the 11th. So,
but how do you know? How do you know it's not on the 11th? I'm asking such a simple question. I'm embarrassed to even ask it because you probably don't want
it. On the 11th?
Yeah, okay, how do you know it's not on the 11th? Okay.
It says it is on the 11th.
I know, but Minolan implies that it shouldn't be on the 11th until you find the source for it. Why is Gemara searching high and low for a source? Because it shouldn't be on the 11th. Prove to me that it's on the 11th. But I'm saying, why is it not on the 11th, Shoshana?
Because it's written in the Megillah.
Exactly! Because the source for our mitzvah of Megillah reading is in the Megillah. It's one of the 24 holy books of the Tanakh. So I opened up Megillat Esther, and lo and behold, it says there that the Megillah is read on the 14th. Or in Shushan on the 15th. It doesn't say anything before. It doesn't say the 11th, it doesn't say the 12th, it doesn't say the 13th. You understand what I'm saying? So that's the Minolan. My point here is that sometimes when you see the word Minolan in the Gemara, you should begin to fill in the missing blanks over here and understand what's the background to this question Minolan. Why is the Gemara so upset here? Unless you find a source. If you don't find a source, I don't want to talk to you. You know, don't even bother the discussion. In this case, because we have an explicit book in the Holy Writ that addresses the issue of when Megillah starts and when the Megillah is read. Okay, now we go on to an interesting Gemara in Yuma. Again about the ladies. The Gemara says Tar Rabbanan. Tar Rabbanan means what? A Braisa. We learned it a Braisa. And it says, who's Chayav in Mezuzah? So first of all, a synagogue is Chayav in Mezuzah. That's interesting. Because L'chora, I don't know, I don't own a synagogue. Nobody owns a synagogue. Upon whom does this obligation evolve? But that's not our point tonight. Because then the Mishnah, the Braisa, excuse me, goes on and says, Beit HaIsha, the house of a woman. What question should you ask here? Pshita. Again, you got to get the language here. Pshita. Pshita means, you didn't have to tell me that. I needed a Braisa to tell me.
So
it's obvious. That's called Pshita. And again, what always comes after Pshita? Mao de Tema with half following by a Kamashmon, correct? I'm just trying to drill it into you. You know, Pshita, it's obvious. Mao de Tema, I might have thought that the Torah says, al Beisecha, right? Beisecha velo Beisa. It's written in the male form, in masculine form. I might think it excludes women. Again, there are deeper layers of meaning over here. You know, why the bias of a woman would not generate a mitzvah of... But on the simple level, the Gemara is just saying it from a grammatical perspective. It's pure digduk. Kamash malon. That, therefore, the Braisa wants to tell me, no, you don't read it in the masculine, but you read it in the neutral. No matter what gender, male or female, you're obligated to put up a mezuzah in your bias. Oh, now we go on. This is very important to me. The Eva Hachinami. Wait a minute. Your logic in the Mao de Tema is very solid. The Torah does say Beisecha in the masculine. So maybe it's so. Maybe we should exclude the women. Again, it only means if a woman has her own house. Omar Kroh, so we have to find another pasuk. Do you follow what I'm saying? So this is a classical structure where if we only had the first verse in the Torah, we would come to a mistaken conclusion, and therefore there's no pshita here. The Mishnah has to tell me kamash malon, and the kamash malon is based on a different verse in the Torah. Again, then the Gemara is going to have all dialectic. So how do we reconcile this verse with that verse? You know, one verse that says leman yirbu yamechem, meaning that you should live a long life. The Torah gives us the hint as to why a person, not why, I wouldn't say why, I'm not talking motivational level, but what reward a person will experience and enjoy as a benefit for putting up a mezuzah.
And it says Laman Yirbu Yemechem. Whenever it says Laman Yirbu Yemechem, it includes both men and women. Because as far as I know, check me if I'm wrong, the women want to live just as long as the men want to live. In most cases, they live longer, you know. That's because they drive us crazy. But anyway, okay.
But from the language, you might say that the pasuk doesn't apply there to women either.
So then the Gemara is going to have to go on and work this all out and see, so why does it say Beischa, etc., etc. Okay. We're running out of time because I wanted to leave some time for questions. So let's just skip for a moment and maybe we'll be able to fill this in next time. Let's go to number 11. The number 11, what I call Hanicha, is a very, very important structure. Hanicha works like this. When the Gemara faces a difficulty in a Mishnah, in understanding a Mishnah, and comes up with a solution, or presents a possible solution, at that point the Gemara goes into a Hanicha, which is like a split, a fork in the road. And what the Gemara does in that case is it introduces a general machlokes, which now we seem to have a proof one way or the other. That's called Hanicha. Okay? So for example, the Mishnah says at the beginning of the final perek of Masechta Yuma, what is Yuma dealing with? Yom Kippur. It says that Yom Kippur is asur, is enjoined from the following list. Now, normally, and again, only the Gemara knows this because of its extreme sensitivity to the language of the Mishnah. Normally, when a Mishnah wants to convey the severity of a criminal act, of a prohibition in the Torah, it will not, if it's applicable, it will not just say asur, but rather it will say anush kares, meaning it's not just a regular rank and file prohibition. You violate kares, whatever kares means, again, that's itself is an issue. So therefore the Gemara is looking for a case where even though it's Yom Kippur and you're not allowed to eat, nevertheless you're eating in a way that's a second level prohibition. It's not the harsh class, first class prohibition, because then the Mishnah would be talking about kares, which is a very high, severe prohibition. We're talking about a regular prohibition. Now, how can you eat on Yom Kippur and not incur that high prohibition, that intense, severe prohibition of kares? No, it's called chatzishir. Chatzishir means when you eat small amounts. That's what it's called, chatzi shir. And chatzi shir is normally, what I'm telling you now is not correct, but just for the dialectic of the Gemara, just to explain, the Gemara is trying to say that chatzi shir normally would not be prohibited, but here in Yom Kippur, the Mishnah is trying to tell me that even chatzi shir is prohibited. To some extent, it calms you down. You know, it takes away what's called the inisem, you know, your state of enduring inui, of denying yourself food. So for example, you could imagine eating the whole day Yom Kippur, but on each occasion eating a small amount. At the end of the day, you can fill up your belly. So the Gemara is saying that normally you might wonder whether this is prohibited, but here, for sure, it's prohibited. So the Gemara says, Ha Nicha, now we're touching on an ancient universal issue that's relevant to Chadash and Nevela and Trefa and Basu B'Cholav and Klayak Kerem and Chametz B'Pesach, etc., etc., etc. Namely, what happens if you eat Chatzi Shir, less than the minimum amount that the Torah stipulates constitutes Achila. And that's a universal machlokes, whether chatzi shir mutter min haTorah or chatzi shir asur min haTorah. Did the Torah prohibit even a chatzi shir, or did the Torah only prohibit a full shir? My point for you tonight is Hanicha. Hanicha means that at this point the Gemara thinks that we should view Yom Kippur from the perspective of the universal rule of chatzi shir, and if the Mishnah here is referring to chatzi shir and it's nevertheless taking the position that it's prohibited, that is Hanicha, that happens to click and represent very well that opinion, Leman Diomer, he who holds, Leman Diomer, he who holds, that Chatzi Shir is Asur Min HaTorah. who happens to be Rabbi Yochanan, who the Gemara is going to present later. So let's just make a summary of what we have tonight. We started with Lama Lila Misni, meaning two concepts that seem identical. We have the case of Pshita, where we spoke about women in Kriyat Shema, called Mashbalan. In the middle we have always a Ma'od Tema. Then we have the case of Asuye Mai, where there's an extra word like Kol, and it's coming to include something. Then we have a case where there are words that seem to block you and say, don't go beyond, don't expand beyond this, you know, point. This is the point of no return. That's called Limu'ute Mai. What's it coming to exclude? Then you have a case where the Mishnah employs a number and there's no need for the number. That's called Minyana Limu'ute Mai. What does the number come to exclude? Then we have a case of a Mishnah that doesn't bring any source for its halacha. In fact, the halacha brought down in Mishnah seems to be contrary to every source that we have. In the case of Megillah Nikreis Bar Bechadasar. Then we had the Pshita Maika Mashmon in terms of a woman's house and its obligation to Megillah. But in that case, the Gemara of Mezuzah. Then the Gemara goes on to say, V'yema Achinami, you know, you've convinced me through the Ma'od Tema of the solid nature of your logic, and therefore, how do you know that women are taka chayev, or base isha's chayev in mezuzah? Then we went on to number Yud Aleph, and we spoke about ha nicha leman tiyomer. So I'm going to take questions now. I'd like you to take this home, and if you can, fill in the missing blanks. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. You have number Chet all the way through to Tes Vav. With the exception of number Yudal. Okay, then, any questions until now?
Which handout are you talking about?
No, it's not. It's not actually a fill out. This is this. You know, each one has a number. What we didn't get to, which I'd like you to look at on your own, yeah, is from Chet all the way to the end Tetvot. Just that I was able to fit in number Yudal. Okay, I hope this will be very helpful, and you're picking up a lot of skills. We are focusing on the structure of the Gemara, the key terminology to help us understand the dialectic of the Gemara, and very soon I think we should be ready for Masechta Megillah. How many people have a Masechta Megillah that we can begin to think that we could start? I don't know.